should know who I am, but you should know why I'm here. My grandpa, Stephen, is the author of a new exciting play called When the Break Happened in Orangeburg County. It's about our ancestors from when the break happened in 1865 until now. Many of my relatives are featured in the play, from my great-great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-grandpa Stephen to my grandpa Stephen. Guess what my uncle and cousin's name are? Stephen. Go to www.thebreakinorangeburg.com to learn more. An online store has been created to honor those relatives and other families with products featuring the Break logo. Go to www.thebreakstore.com to purchase items today and help to produce this play. Please!
Welcome to a new podcast show about stuff. It's the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Here's your host, Stephen Davis.
Hello, we're back with a show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Welcome. We're going to explore entrepreneurship and the historic accomplishments of three wonderful guests that I have today. I want to introduce our three guests, and we're going to introduce them by age, who gets the most honor. And oh, I guess that's you, Joe, huh? What's the company that you're CEO of again, Joe?
Them Choice Technologies, LLC.
And formerly, you were the head of, what was the company again?
Protelcon.
That's Joe invented an everyday device that all of us use at some point in our lives. And that is?
The programmable remote control and the timer that's on your DVR that lets you set it so it records if you're away from home, and several other things.
What was the other one? The one that people use every day when they wake up and the first thing that they click?
It's a remote control.
Okay. And I must say that I had the privilege of being involved with from way back. The next guest that I have on is John Atchison, CEO of John Atchison's Salon here in New York. And back in the 70s and 80s, if you were a Black upcoming woman or had made it, you went to John Atchison's Salon. If you wasn't going to John, you wasn't getting your hair done right.
Start out in Brooklyn?
No, I started out in South Carolina, Spartanburg, South Carolina.
All of y'all are Southern boys that live in the big city now. And finally, I have on Sir Carlton Brown, a real estate developer. I welcome you all to the show, and I thank you all. Joe, you go ahead and tell something about yourself.
Yeah, I came from originally New Orleans, Louisiana, and joined the Army at 18 with less than a seventh grade education. Got in the Army, got a GED, and then studied radio and television. Got stationed at Fayetteville, North Carolina. Studied radio and television, opened a shop right there in Fayetteville, sold it during the day and fixed TVs and nights and weekends. And that's where I got the vast amount of knowledge with respect to radio and television. And that's where I met Steve. He worked for another guy who owned a Black guy who owned a TV shop. I did wound up doing 20 years in the service and ultimately wound up out here in California as an Army recruiter. But by that time, I had did some undergraduate work, and then I ultimately wound up with a PhD in applied science and technology. I presently have acquired 6 U.S. patents. The first patent was for the programmable television receiver controllers. Now, in a word, I did not invent the original remote, but all it could do at that time was turn the TV on and off, change channels, and run the volume up and down. What your remote do now, all the capabilities, is a test to my addendum to it and made it programmable, you see. Now, if you go back to the old VCR, when it first came out, it didn't have a means of timing it so you could leave home and it would record automatically. Well, I invented that and bridged that gap. Now that has progressed to the DVR. So it's built into your TV now. So if you leave home and you want to record several programs and have them waiting for you to come back home, well, that's my technology. And I was the original one that came up with the parental control to allow parents to block out violent and objectionable programming to their impressionable age. In fact, I spoke in the House of Representatives, chaired by Ed Markey of Massachusetts, about that when they were clamoring about the networks having a lot of negative programming and affecting our children. So I spoke about that. And ultimately, now you know what they do. It's called a V-chip, which allows parents to block out valid and objectionable programming. And then that progressed into me doing some study on the female anatomy. So I did some study through New England Journal of Medicine and Massachusetts Journal and learned a little bit about the female anatomy. Hooked up with one of the foremost OBGYN specialists out here. You know of him, you may not know him. His name was Dr. William Haling. Dr. Haling was the chief of OBGYN at Martin Luther King Jr. Medical Center here. And so when I came up with this concept for a means of allowing a woman to have an alternative to birth control, so I came up with this little device. It's about the size of a woman's little power pack. And where the mirror normally would be, there's a little screen in which you put her period information in there. See, when it came, how long it lasts, and what is her cycle. Now, so most women are 28 days, but this one goes from 26, 27, 28, 29, and 30. So she can put that in three things: when it came, how long it lasts, and what is the cycle. And then it'll calculate, and the calendar comes up on the screen. See? And then it shows ovulation day in red, and it shows her save day in green. It shows the functionary days in yellow, and it shows the menstruation days in purple. See? And then it's automatic. It automatically lets her know every month. And once she programs it, it allows her to look forward also. Say, for instance, if she'd like to get married 3 or 4 months down, want to stand and take a vow without her period on, and just allow her to look forward and choose a weekend that she knows that she's saved and her marriage. And then off of that, when we have one that I presently have in Los Angeles Unified Schools. It's a little, it's an app, but it's also made in a little handheld, but it doesn't show any ovulation. It just shows the little girl's period. You're talking about little girl 9 through 16. And we have a curriculum also built in that. And now I have that in LA Unified, and now we're getting ready to put it in the cloud and download it in schools across the country. What it has is everything that a little girl 9 through 16 needs to know about her body at the onset of puberty, see? Because we have 1.1 million unintended teen pregnancies in the country, and nobody's doing anything about it. With this unit, I have everything. It's a comprehensive unit that covers every aspect of how babies are made, STD prevention, everything that she needs to do. And it's all been vetted by the Los Angeles PTA. And the Film Advisory Board here in Hollywood, they're the ones that put the R's and X's on the movies for family-oriented programs. So now we have that, and we're going to be downloading it in the schools across the country, and it'll finally wind up on a little girl's tablet, because the kids now have these little tablets in school. And it will reside there for her for 1 year, and she will have a full comprehensive a bit of information about how her body works. Because most of them go out here at 14, 15 and get pregnant because they don't, nobody's told them anything except keep your dress down. So that's what I'm currently working on now, trying to raise funds for that. And I also try and help inventors that contact me. I do a lot of lecturing, so a lot of people contact me and ask me questions about how to acquire trademarks and things like that.
I see that evidently John dropped off for a while, so I'm going to let you, Carlton, go out of turn. You're the youngest of the crowd, but talk about yourself.
I'm not really good about talking about myself and what I did in the past, because it's all past. But anyhow, I was born in Charlotte, North Carolina, and we moved to Jackson, Mississippi when I was 6 years old. My folks moved down there. Actually, before that, I was born in Charlotte, and then we lived in Bluefield, West Virginia. My dad was a teacher at Bluefield State Teachers College. He was a chemistry teacher. I had a PhD in chemistry. And after Emmett Till got lynched, my father was also a World War II vet, decided that we needed to move to Mississippi because he said if there was a fire, you needed to run toward it to put it out because otherwise it would burn up everything. That's kind of how World War II Black vets start. That was their MO. Mm-hmm. So we moved to Mississippi with my mom screaming and kicking because she was sure we were all going to get lynched and die. And so we moved there, and they were taught at Jackson State and were involved in the civil rights movement. I grew up there and went to all public schools there, all, obviously all segregated public schools there.
left there and went to college at Princeton University, majored in architecture and urban planning, finished school in 73, and was not committed to being employed by anybody. So I started my first company, which is I was a sports agent. Another brother named Greg Howard and the sister named Lois. We started a sports agency named Howard and Brown Associates. Mm-hmm. And we represented a number of professional athletes, largely athletes that came from the SWAC, Southwestern Athletic Conference, because at that time, these kids did not go to University of Alabama or LSU or Georgia. They went to Jackson State and Texas Southern and Alcorn and Southern, and they tended not to have good representation. So we represented a number of those players, football players, a couple basketball players, a couple baseball players. And I did that for about 3 years and just kind of, not that I have a whole lot of moral turpitude at that time, certainly I didn't. I have more now than I had at that time. But at that time, when your mom says, look, you got this degree in architecture and urban planning, what are you doing with these athletes? And you can't tell your mom, I'm getting them white women and drugs. You
know? Tell a story about your partner. What happened with your partner?
Oh, Greg Howard? Now, Greg Howard is an interesting character, right? So about the time we decided to leave the business, also about the time Greg Howard absconded with the money. And he shows up working for Mr. Sutton, Percy Sutton, as a general manager, no, as a sales manager for a station that Mr. Sutton had in the Bay Area. I think he had a station in the Bay Area and another one in Los Angeles. And Lois Wright, who had been our partner, also ended up working for Mr. Sutton. And Mr. Sutton says to Lois, says, Lois, you know, we're number one in the market in the Bay Area, but for some reason, our revenues just seem really down. I don't understand that. And so Lois, she asked, young Mr. Sutton was just a really proper gentleman, never broke a verb, never raised a voice. And so he says, he used to call Lois attorney, Counselor Wright. Counselor, can you please go out to San Francisco and report back to me what's going on there? So she goes out there. She sees Greg Howard as the sales manager. What Greg was doing was taking all the revenues, barely recording them, but putting them into the trade bank. And instead of it flowing to the bottom line, he took it in trade. He was driving in a Maserati. He was doing this. He was doing that. And of course, that was the last days of Greg Howard, right? You would think. So years later, I come home from work. My kids, I have kids, they're watching the BET Image Awards. And I see just the tail end of it. And they said, and the winner of the BET Image Award is Greg Howard. Now, I'm like, that can't be fucking. And it's Greg Howard's about 6'8", 290 black man. It's like, how many 6'8", 290 black men? I'm like, goddamn. So I call Lois. I'm like, Lois, you are not going to believe this stuff. I said, Greg Howard won an NAACP Image Award. He said, for what? I'm like, I have no idea. I just saw it. How are you calling me lying about this? And so look it up. He won the NAACP Image Award because he was the screenwriter for Remember the Titans, right? And so what he had done, he had become a screenwriter. And Greg was a brilliant person. And so I wondered, did Greg steal that screenplay from? I know he took it from somebody. He's done a lot of screenplays. He just recently did the one for, what was it, Harriet Tubman, I think, that had a little run in the movies. And the last time I talked to him, he said, I've really gone straight since we used to be together. I'm like, you are not in prison. It's a testament to that. So that was my business partner.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyhow, I left that business and I went to work for an architect and I hated it. Drawing little lines on a piece of paper. This was before all this AutoCAD, automated drafting. This was when you had pen and pencil and on Mylars. It was tedious. It was boring. I couldn't stand it. And so every about twice a month, this white boy who was a few years younger than me, Tracy, who had graduated from the Naval Academy. He'd come by the office, he'd look at the drawings, say, change this, change that, change this, and he'd go. And I'm like, what is this dude Tracy doing? So I said, Tracy, man, we need to have lunch. So we had, I'm like, so Tracy, what do you do? He says, I work for AT&T and their asset management group. And so what do you do other than come tell me to change drawings? He says, we are the largest real estate company in the world because we own all of AT&T's real estate assets. I buy property, I develop buildings, I look at drawings like yours, I do leases, I manage an entire portfolio for a certain part of the country. And so now when I was a sports agent, I probably made $200,000 a year. And this was like in 72, 73, 74, which was real money. When I was an architect, I was making $9 an hour from living large to $9 an hour. And so I said, that was another reason I didn't like architecture, drawing all those little lines for $9 an hour. Tracy, how much did they pay you for this job? He says, I make $40,000 a year. And I was like, people make $40,000 a year for something legit without having to go get hose for athletes? That's what my mind was saying. So where's the employment office for this place? I go to the employment office. They give you AT&T's, the phone company, right? They give you a little test. Can you spell cat? What's 4 plus 4? What's 3 times 3? And so everybody, I think, passes the test because the phone company employed everybody. You could be on a switchboard plugging in things. So they said, you pass a test and we're going to see what kind of jobs we have for you. And say, what are you interested in? I said, I'm interested in asset management, right? And they're like, asset management? Who told you about that? And I said, that's something I've always wanted to do, work in asset management. I have a degree in architecture and planning, work for an architecture firm. And I worked on developing a prototype building for you guys. And I said, oh, okay. We'll get back to you, see if there are any jobs in the asset management group. They get back to me. A little later, they say, we don't have any jobs in the asset management group, but we can start you in something else. I'm like, no, I'm not interested in that. Literally, a couple of days later, New York Times, the AT&T has to sign a consent decree for not hiring Black people in management and not promoting them. I'm like, oh, yeah, this game is coming to me now. So they call me back. They said, we think we have an opening in asset management. I'm like, okay. So I go up, they interview me. It's the whole, back in the day, how offices where you'd have a 40,000 foot floor plate with just nothing but little people sitting at desk. And some guy in the corner office ran the joint, the other little. So I go up there, it's a desk full of white men. I'm like, not a Black man, not a Black woman, not even a Black clerical worker. I'm like, oh, I see how this works. So they interview me. He says, oh, yeah, I'd really like to talk to you. I think we might be able to find a place in this organization. So they send me back to personnel, and they say they can offer me a job making $30,000 a year. Now, this is less than the white boy was making, a lot less than I had been making, but a lot more than I was making at the architect's office. And I'm like, I can't do that. He says, what are you looking for? I'm like, if I can't make at least $60,000 a year, I just can't see changing careers at this point. They say, oh, no, we just can't pay you that. You guys read the paper here, and you've heard about the problem you guys have with the court. And then the white people go ashen then. They said, we just can't pay you that much. I'm like, that's fine. They called me back about 2 weeks later and said, we think we found a way. And they said, we have a management training program. It's called MDIP, right? And we'll hire you. And we'll actually pay you more than $60,000. You can make $75,000. But if you haven't made division manager in 5 years, we're going to fire you. And I'm thinking, boy, I'm going to make $75,000. It's a gravy train. And went to heaven. I take the job and I made division manager within the 5 years. Probably been there about 7 years. I was okay, now, you know what? I am just too through with these white people. I've had this, and I was ready to leave. And I was talking to my mom and dad. They said, when does your pension get vested? I'm like, pension get vested? 20 some years old. I'm not even, maybe I'm 30. I don't even think I'm 30 then. I'm like, pension vested? That's for old people. I just check on it. And not that I always listen to my parents, but I'm like, let me just check this out. So I go to the personnel. They said, yeah, your pension gets vested after 10 years. Okay, and what does that mean? That means after 10 years, if you retire at 65, you'll get 75% of your salary you were getting when you were working. That got my attention. So I worked there 3 more years, 10 years and a day. And I worked there through the time they were breaking up the phone company. I went to start up a new company called Bell Communications Research. I stayed there to my 10 years and a day. And I left, I started my own business, and I've been in my own business ever since. That was 1986. And so I've been doing real estate development, sometimes successfully, sometimes unsuccessfully. What I always tell young people I talk to is, I'm saying, look, let me just tell you this. I would venture to say 70 to 80% of the things I've ever tried didn't work. But the other 20, 30%, they were grand slams, worked out fine. And so something not working or failing on something should just like really not deter you. And if you're succeeding on everything, I just think you've probably set the bar too low. And I've done work here in New York. I've done buildings on my own account in Harlem, at Battery Park City, in Brooklyn. Probably, I don't even know, probably a few $100 million for work, $300-400 million. We did the Solaire at Battery Park City. We did the Kalahari in Harlem. We did 1400 Fifth in Harlem.
I want to get into some of the stuff you did, but I want to first go to John to let John talk. Some of the questions I want to ask you all are questions that each one of y'all could answer the same question. Okay, John, you go. I want to say, John was the man in the 70s. I remember John Acheson back in the 70s.
Thank you, Stephen, for the introduction. It's an honor to be on this podcast with you guys. I didn't want you to stop, and I wanted you to keep on going. So Stephen said we'll get it. But I wanted to say, I came from South Carolina in 56, and I always thought about doing hair, but it wasn't something that straight guys did. And so I stayed away from it. But I finally reached it on a 29 and I said, look, what is the easiest way to meet women? I said, I'm not going to be a barber. And I said, okay, I'm working at Bellevue Hospital as a nurse's aide. And I left that and went to the transit. I'm working in a token booth selling tokens. I couldn't talk to anybody in token booth. Every woman you talk to was trying to catch a train. I had a friend of mine. He was a fireman, Charles Rome. Charles said, look, man, why don't you go to beauty school? I met a guy who was in this business. And then I saw some guys, some young guys in Queens, at Gentleman's Three out in Queens off of Merrick Boulevard. These cats, man, they were straight. They were cool. They had cars. They had a lot of women coming to their shop. I said, I'm going to beauty. But I did. So while in beauty school, I'm like, I'm working in the subway at night, going to beauty school during the day. And I hardly ever slept. But I knew this was what I wanted to do. I would see young girls on the train, on the subway, and they were beautiful, but their hair was always jacked up. And I would, like, in my mind, just rearrange their hair and see a whole different look on them. So I said, well, I want to know how to make that happen. Well, I go to beauty school, I finally graduate. My friend Charles, he said, John, look, man, don't go work in the neighborhood. I'll come downtown, 57th Street, get a job down there. They're not even doing the things you learn in beauty school. So I go down there to, it was Henri Bendel's. Now back then, they had four sections. They had the white section for white clients, the black section for black clients, then they had the Hispanic section for Hispanic clients, and then the Asian section for Asian clients. You talk about segregation. I couldn't get hired there, but I remember passing a shop on Madison Avenue at 68th Street called Vidal Sassoon's. At that time, they didn't have anybody working there that was black. I went there to be interviewed, and the manager, who I later found out was a black guy, he was very fair-skinned. He looked like he was Jewish. He was on the edge of passing. He let me know who he was later on. I went in and we interviewed, bam. I said to myself, sooner or later, as you were saying, Carlton, they're gonna need to hire someone black because it's against the law. I kept going back, and I would go back every month for 7 months. I would go back and be interviewed. During that time, I bought scissors that Sassoon had put out. I bought a book that he had written, and I started cutting hair turning the page in the book and cutting what I saw in the pictures and cutting anybody's hair who would let me. I finally got in, and Edward told me, the guy's name, the manager was Edward. He said, I made it hard for you because I wanted to see how bad you really wanted it. And I knew when you got in, these guys in here were going to make it hard for you. Anyway, I went through this training program of sweeping floors and shampooing and running errands and done all this stuff. But I'm learning how to cut hair. I'm learning how to cut white women's hair. I'm learning how to cut black women's hair. And I'm learning Asian. And I get this technique down. And after a year, close to about a year and a few months, I graduated to have my own chair and began to cut hair and build a clientele. My thoughts were two things. What I had learned, I realized I didn't know anybody in our community that was doing hair this way, was cutting hair with these techniques. Now it's all over. So I said, I'm going to start a business. And I'm going to create jobs and train my stylists the same way I was trained. And so when I graduated, I told them I was graduating and I'll move on to get my own salon. Now, Vidal and I, his salon was the top salon in the country. He had come over from London. He brought this technique of cutting hair with scissors and only scissors, no clippers or anything like that. He wasn't teasing the hair. He wasn't making hair high up on top of women's head. He was cutting it in a way where the hair moved, it was dramatic, and very few people could do that. I'm learning from the best people in the business how to cut this hair this way. I moved on up the ladder. I made the artistic team. And then eventually they needed a manager. Vidal thought I was strong enough to do that. They promoted me to manager. So now I'm managing three shops in Manhattan. And not knowing anything about managing anything, not even managing myself, because you know I was having fun along the way. I said there were women, right? I was having a ball. And then I realized that's not my goal. My goal is to create job opportunity. And the only way I was going to do that was have my own. Because these people were not going to hire anybody black. Now, I did. I brought in my barber. He got a job there, Philip Jackson. He became a barber at Sassoon's. A young lady I met at White Castle, she was going to beauty school. I brought her in. And several other guys that I knew that wanted to get into the business but learn at the top level, I brought them in. My cousin was a hairstylist. In fact, he did the hair for Superfly. And so he came in and he learned that technique. Then later on, his mother, him and I, we opened up the first shop on 55th Street. Now, 55th Street was a hot block. You had Lloyd Price had an office there. Reginald Lewis had an office on that street. And then you had William Morris Agency, and all of the entertainers that they handled, the black entertainers, would come past the shop. So we were in a strategic spot. Like you were saying, Stephen, people were coming to get these John Atchison haircuts. My goal wasn't so much to create these looks as much as it was to train people to create them. I started teaching. And then I met a guy named Philippe Bascon. And he said, John, we should go on the road and teach haircutting. So then we started going to trade shows and teaching in Chicago and Atlanta, the Bronner Brothers show. And then I ventured out to London. I'm teaching wherever I go, I'm teaching haircutting. And I learned the teaching basically from teaching my own staff. And many of the people that I train now, we're good friends. They have their own business now. And so from there, I decided to put the instructions on video and tapes back then. And I started recording these haircutting techniques on the VHSs. And then I would take them to the trade shows and then we would sell them. Many of the entertainers would start coming to me. I met so many people.
Let me just add this one thing in, John. In 1999, you were honored as being one of the 75 educators of the century.
I was surprised in the sense that I didn't know they were doing the article and including me in it, number one. But what it did is confirmed that I had reached a level where people were recognizing my teaching skills. And it really came hard work. I would go to London. I would go to Canada, wherever there was a haircutting class. Even though I learned from the best of Sassoon's, I wanted to keep up. So I would travel to Europe and say, they have the best cutters in London. I'm going with that. And so my cousin and I, we went there. I went to Canada class, wherever I could get a class in cutting hair. And that's what I would do. And so having the opportunity to train my staff, it gave me a lot of practice. And so it came about not by me. I say it wasn't a goal to be an educator. It was my goal to be able to train my staff so that they could do what I did and do the clients that came into the salon at a quality level, be professional. They had to wear uniforms. They had to be on time. I got some great stories about that. And then they just had to be professional in the salon. There was no cursing, no fooling around. We took care of business, got the clients, and got them out. Then when I got saved, they really couldn't do a whole lot. I couldn't do a whole lot once I got saved. But I eventually turned the salon into what I call a Christian fellowship salon, where people could come and read Christian material and so forth. And they enjoyed it, man. Because the whole, they said, those who knew me when I first started, and then they said, you're not the same guy. You changed. I got out of that era alive. People were dying, man. Yeah, I'm telling you. I said, thank God I'm alive and I'm going to go straight, okay?
I want the audience to know that your wife was one that all three of us used to drool over. And you talked about the Superfly
piece. Right.
It's Sheila Frazier, who was in Superfly.
And when I met her, Camille Cosby and Bill Cosby, they were clients of mine. In fact, I was their personal hairstylist for years and still, actually still to this day. But the thing about it, she sent Sheila to me. She said, you got to go see my hairstylist. So Sheila came in and I consulted with her. And I fell in love with her immediately. I didn't even remember the movie, even though I saw it. But you know, that was years ago. What impressed me about her was that she was talking about the Bible. And I just started reading about it. And I said, I never met a woman this fine talking about God. And so, because the women I knew were talking about God. And I wasn't talking to them about God. But this woman was persistent. That began our relationship. And that was the basis of it. She lived in California, of course, and I lived in New York. So we would communicate. I said, when I come to California, I'll cut your hair. And she did. She came to me. I was in the name of the hotel. But anyway, she came to the hotel to get a haircut. So I would go back and tell the guy, man, I cut you in my hotel. And they said, yeah, okay, what else? I said, that was it. It was always that. I mean, like, you put God up and said, okay, hands off. That's it. And during that time, Camille, God, Gloria Foster, all these women started coming to me, from Cicely Tyson, Felisa Rashad. And Bill asked me to create the looks for the Cosby Show. Annie Glover, Nancy Wilson. I was her personal hairstylist. Whenever she came to the Blue Note, she would always include me in the group. And Alfie Woodard, Daphne Reed, and my main man, Muhammad Ali. He used to come in. His wife said, I was the only one that could cut his hair. She said, why don't you teach some of these other hairstylists? I said, they have to come to New York, come to a hair show to get me. So then, and just... the clients were coming from all over. George Dinkins, when Mayor Dinkins was inaugurated and all, they brought me in to do that. Or she came into this one. Dionne Warwick, Lynn Whitfield, Ed Lewis, Leslie Adams. In fact, Leslie and her husband was the one who told me I should open a salon in California. And that's what, you know, eventually I did. Started training stylists out there. And then Alfred Wood said, well, why don't you work on your product line and just leave the salons alone for a while. And that's what I did. I started a hair care line, but I didn't push it as far as I planned to, because I made so many mistakes, because I didn't know what I was doing with products. But now I realize I did my homework, so we're coming out with a line. In fact, I'm working on an organic line. I have a generic line now, so I'm gonna be working on that. But it's been a journey, I'm telling you. But one of the highlights, Cicely Tyson came to me and asked me to escort her or be her guest. She's going to the White House where Harry Belafonte was being given the Kennedy Center Awards. And she said, would you go? I said, let me think about it, because George Bush was president and I wasn't a fan of George Bush. So a friend of mine said, look, that's the president, you go. So I went. Cicely treated me like I was a brother. And for years, we were friends. And then she went back again and she asked me to go back with her again. Golden Globes, she asked me to Golden Globes with her. And I knew her when she was married to Miles. So I got to meet Miles Davis, spend time with him. And that man, he was awesome, funny. And I'll say one thing, Miles could be rude as anything, but people loved him in spite of all of that. He'd come into the salon and said, till you talk to the woman, he said, can I blow my horn through your hair? Oh no, just that Miles, I became good friends. I got some great shots with Miles, and it was amazing the people that I met as a result of doing hair at the level that we were doing it. And I envisioned that. I said, one day our women are going to want to go to a salon where it's professional, the people are well-trained, they can be treated like the great women that they are. and they're going to go to white salons if they don't have anyone black to do their hair. So I said, well, I'm going to be the one to provide that for them. And that was my motivation, really, and to create jobs for young black stylists who were coming up, because they weren't going to get into Sassoons during that time. They weren't going to get into these white shops to learn these techniques. I had the opportunity to learn it. So let me bring it back to the community and train them. And what motivated me to do that was a book called A Spook Who Sat by the Door. And after reading that book, I said, that's it. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get this information. I'm going to take it back to the neighborhood. And I'm going to train stylists to do this at this level so they can start making these big bucks and charging $100 and $200 for it. So that was it.
Fantastic story.
I have to thank God for the opportunity that I've had. And like once I got into ministry, I started preaching to the clients along with doing the hair. So I tell them, you can feel good on the outside and leave here knowing Jesus as your Lord and Savior. So you're going to feel good on the inside as well.
I remember after I left Burgess TV service, Joe, and that's because Burgess wouldn't pay nothing. I got a job with the North Carolina Natural Gas at the time as a meter reader. Now, understand, being a meter reader in the summer is not bad. But in the winter, I had gotten married, got an account with Household Finance. One day, making a payment, and the manager, white manager, came out front and said, do you want a job here as a management trainee? And I said, run from dogs, getting bitten by dogs, or sitting with a tie and a suit on in the back in the air condition and a pay raise? After I took the job, I discovered the reason why I was hired was because the household had to find blacks to get into management training program. And that's why he hired me. I learned one thing: when an opportunity comes, you walk through the door. Yeah. Don't care how you got the job. The fact is that you keep going. Yeah. That's what I see all of you gentlemen have done in your life. Yeah. Tell me from you all's perspective, and I'm going to start with the oldest again, Joe. What were some of the hardest obstacles as being an entrepreneur you faced?
In North Carolina, I found that when my first little shop burned down, and the suppliers there that sold me parts all got together and gave me a line of credit, and I was able to start again in the mart. When I look at white people, man, I've seen some white people that I wouldn't be where I am now had I not stood on their shoulders. And then I've seen some up on the corporate level where I am now, I don't have access to serious capital. And so when I look at what holds us back right now, is access to capital, okay? And then another thing, I find that one of the biggest problems we have, a lot of our social organizations, black social organizations, all the big ones, they have gatekeepers, okay? So it's so hard to get to the principal to let them know that you have something that's viable that they can get involved in and get behind. And it took me a long time to get in Google where you could see what my inventions are. And I'm alive in my technologies all over the world, but just trying to get through gatekeepers to get to where you can make a serious decision on a high level. And those are some of the things that I have suffered and still suffer, because there are a lot of people that would support what I'm doing, trying to deal with this 1.1 million unintended teen pregnancies in the country that's been pervasive for years, okay? And so that's the problem, just trying to get out there, let people know what you're doing, and then collectively we can help solve some problems. So that's awesome.
Carlton, I know that you're the man who raises lots and lots of money. What are some of the obstacles that you faced along the way in doing that?
More obstacles than you can say. I used to tell my wife, I got to go get my knee pads out because I'm going begging and I can't tell you what else I might do. And so the thing is, raising money, clearly, African-Americans having access to capital is a huge challenge. I don't think is that we have a shortage of ideas or a shortage of determination or bad work habits. I think we've got all those sort of things. And the capital markets at a certain scale just haven't been open to us. For my projects, I tend to have to raise a lot of capital in the combination of debt and equity, et cetera, et cetera. And so for the first really large project that I did on my own account, guy, old Jewish guy, really nice guy. He was He must have been in his 90s, and he had more money than the law allowed. And I needed, this was for 1400 Fifth, a project, about a $50 million condominium deal that was going to be the first affordable green condominium in the country. And I needed to get over a hurdle to get to a closing. I needed someplace between $500,000 and $1 million. And someone introduced me to this guy, and I went to see him, and I talked to him. And the thing that he got, because, and this is a sort of interesting thing. I was just talking to someone else about this. He was a Holocaust survivor. And Jewish people that were Holocaust survivors have a whole different attitude about struggle. And so when I came to him and was telling him my story and what we were trying to do, he put me through some changes. But he essentially wrote a check for $600,000. And, you know, I had to pay him back. But the main thing he wanted to do was for me to come talk to him. So I'd have to have breakfast with him two or three times a month. And I learned more from that, from talking to him, just about how these things work and getting introductions to other places. And so on the one hand, just running into that angel, right? That's the Lord. That ain't me. Yeah. That's the Lord at work. And so one, running into that angel gets you to a certain place. But then what you have to do is build on that. You have to build a track record. You have to build a track record of success so you have a more compelling story to tell. Yeah. And so over time, I had more compelling stories to tell. I think about the other people that were helpful. Frank Borges, who at the time was the treasurer for the state of Connecticut, right? And he was the sole trustee. And when I met Frank, I was trying to raise money to buy multifamily housing developments. And I went to Frank, and Frank says, I like what you're doing, blah, 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 let's do this. He put me together with an advisor there, and every deal I took to the advisor said no. So Frank called me one day and says, how come you haven't done any deals? I'm like, your advisor keeps turning me down, says every deal's bad. So he says, can you be up here in Hartford tomorrow? I'm like, sure, Frank. So he says, I want you in my office at 8 o'clock. And I'm going to be at Hartford at 8 o'clock in the morning. And that means I got to drive, because you can't catch a train from New York and get to Hartford by 8 o'clock in the morning. So I drove up to Hartford in Frank's office at 8 o'clock, and he brought in his advisor. And it was a guy from AE, Aldrich, Eastman and Wallet. And he said to the guy named Marvin, he says, Marvin, which part of this you do not understand? I said, I want to do deals with this guy. You haven't given him any money. He's brought you a bunch of deals. Which part of I want to do deals with this guy is that you don't understand? And he says, well, Mr. Borges, I understand. No, he says, you don't understand, because it's been 6 months and not a single deal has been done. And so I'm going to call you in here again in a month. And if there are no deals done, that'll be the last time your company does business with the state of Connecticut. And so we got two deals done in a month, right? And so again, that's, I think sometimes when you have a positive attitude and you're really putting out that vibe, I think God guides you to the right people. You don't even have to find them. Yeah. They'll find you. And so when I met Steve, not long ago, purchased the UN Plaza Hotel from the city of New York. And again, that was a $110 million transaction. And so Frank, just about that time, because we had done the right thing, made money, we made money, was Connecticut. He had left state of Connecticut and gone to GE Capital. Frank calls me in one day and he says, so Carlton, what do you know about hotels? I'm like, nothing. He says, I got a guy who's one of my clients, GE Capital clients, a guy named Mr. Y.S. Lowe, he was one of the five wealthiest people in the world, Hong Kong business person. And this was before everyone in Hong Kong knew that the British contract with China was going to run out and it was going to go back to Chinese control. And so the Hong Kong billionaires were trying to get as much of their capital out of Hong Kong as they could into the West. And he says, Mr. Lowe, he wants to buy hotels here in the United States. Can you help him? I'm like, yeah. I don't know anything about hotels today. But give me 3 weeks, and I can have an intelligent conversation with him. So about a month later, I get a call from Mr. Lowe. Frank and I are talking. He says, look, I want you to go get these hotels for me, blah, 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 blah. And I'm still thinking, is this real? So I guess it was in 92 or whenever it was that David Dinkins finished his term and Giuliani became the mayor. Because when David Dinkins was there, I tried to get a meeting with David Dinkins about buying the UN Plaza Hotel. Now, I got Mr. Lowe's money behind me, in spite of probably having raised $200,000-$300,000 for David Dinkins when he was running for mayor. Plus, stopping out, we were doing a lot of development out here in Brooklyn. When he had run, we had just given our workers days off and paid them, and they took people to the polls. Couldn't get a meeting with this guy to talk about this. And finally, I got a meeting with somebody that worked for Dave, and they said, I can't imagine how a guy like you could raise the kind of money we would want for that hotel. And Dave Dinkins loses. But in that process, Governor Pataki wanted to run for president. A guy I know who is a Black Republican, I can't even remember his name, out on Staten Island, he calls me and says, Carlton, you're from Mississippi. I'm like, yeah. He says, Governor Pataki has to do these rounds with all these Republican governors, and he needs to go to Mississippi to meet with the governor of Mississippi. I'm like, and? He says, it's bad optics for him to go to Mississippi because he's trying to run as a moderate Republican to go meet with the governor of Mississippi, and there's not any Black people in the room. I'm like, and? He says, can you get some Black people in the room? I'm like, I could, but why should I, right? He says, you'll have a chip on the table with the governor. I'm like, yeah, I don't know about that. I need to talk to the governor about this. He says, well, let me see if I can make an arrangement for you to talk with the governor. I'm like, no, I need to talk to the governor in person because UN Plaza Hotel was owned jointly by the city and the state. So I get a meeting with Pataki. I said, look, I can make this happen, but I need to be sure that when it comes time for me to talk to you again, I have a fair shot of purchasing the UN Plaza Hotel. He said, we weren't even talking about doing that. I'm like, if you want this meeting, that's what you're going to have to make happen. So he looked me in the eye, he says, well, you can make this happen. That's fine. I'm like, cool. So I call a bunch of my friends back at home. One of them, very interesting, Charlene Stemley, was in the process of suing the governor and the state for mistreating Black prisoners at the state prison in Parchman. But there must have been 20 Black professionals in the governor's mansion for this guy for the photo op. Now, the governor of Mississippi couldn't figure out where these niggas came from up in here. Get back. He sets up a meeting for me with the head of the UN Plaza Hotel. We sit down, we talk about, I want to do this deal. He says, okay, we have to have an RFP. I'm like, I don't care about an RFP as long as I win. And so about a month later, they invite me over there. And he has these two young white kids, just got their first haircut out of business school, right? And he says, we need you to help them put together the RFP for this hotel. And so I helped them put the RFP together for the hotel. And as a consequence, it was written so nobody else on the earth could win that hotel other than us. And that's about the time I met you, Steve, about that time.
Well, we met just before when you were in negotiations for it. Because we held, when I started the Black Education Network, we held the debut at the UN Plaza Hotel.
Among the things in the RFP, you said you had 30 days to do due diligence. Well, we had a year to do due diligence. The hotel was built on land leases, on three different land leases by three different owners that were not co-terminating, right? That's one thing. It wasn't built as a condominium, but the lower floors were an office building and the upper floors were a hotel. And they had two lobbies, an office lobby and a hotel. So all of that had to be split up into two separate condominiums. The land leases had to be negotiated and broken into two pieces for three different land leases. And that was just a lot of legal work. But Mr. Lowe paid for all the legal work for that time. We had probably $800,000 in legal bills before the RFP. So when the RFP came out, no one else could do that. But just in case, what we had is that for to submit a bid, you had to submit a $10 million non-refundable deposit. So if you got the bid and couldn't close within 30 days, then you lost your $10 million. And so guess how many bids they got for the project? One. In some cases, raising capital has really been based on maintaining quality relationships with people. And even now, where Goldman Sachs Urban Investment Group has been one of our primary sources of capital and then some more closed-end funds, it's really all been based on relationships. Because when I say raise capital, typically I have to raise any place from $5 to $10 million in equity and any place from $30 to $100 million in debt. And I wasn't born into a family that knew those people, but it's just relationships that I've cultivated. And that's not to say it's easy, but for the type of work I do for real estate projects, it's gotten easier over time.
Great, great. John?
Hey, well, thank you for that. That was, I knew there was more coming. That's awesome. Awesome journey. God bless you, man. Yeah, mine was not raising millions, but I had to raise $100,000 to start my first salon. And that was, I thought was going to be easy. And my brother, who's an accountant, at least he called himself that, and he put the numbers together. And he had just gotten out of school. Actually, he finished like a accounting course. He didn't go to college to do it. He did an accounting course. And he agreed to put our business plan together. And he did the numbers. So we go to Citibank. Actually, no, it wasn't Citibank. I think we went to Chase Chemical Bank. And there was an officer there, an African-American girl, Black girl. She said that we didn't have the presentation that was professional, but we had all the information. And so she said, I'm going to approve it. Her superior came and looked at the situation. And she said, no, she canceled it. Well, why? Because they had just funded a salon on 57th Street by a Black woman named Gina Wheeler. They fought it on the loan. And so since my business, someone in the salon business had fought it on the loan, then they said, no, we're not going to take any more salons. So this woman, I don't remember her name, she said, look, I'm going to send you over to Citibank. And there's a man there, Joe Blunt. And what he's going to do is he can hook you up. So when we got to him, he said, well, they had a lending area in Citibank to loan money to Hispanics who wanted to go in business. So he put us in that program and we were able to get the $100,000. Yeah. We get the money there and we started the construction and I'm trying to help my people. So now I hire a construction guy went to Commerce High School with him, and he said he was in construction. I said, good, man, I'll hire you. You can build my salon. This guy had the ceiling looking like it was had waves in it. He was using clothes hangers to support the framing for the ceiling. The doors were uneven. So when I ordered this glass, two glass doors for the entrance, they couldn't fit in the frame because he didn't measure it out. I gave him all this money and the thing just went, it was a mess. So we've had to bring in another construction firm to redo practically the whole salon. We got through that. Now I go to California, I want to open a salon in California and I got to raise money for that. But I had a good credit. I also had a track record but I needed some seed money. And so I was ugly's here. So she said she would loan me $30,000. I first had to get a loan from the bank. And if the bank approved me for $100,000, she would loan me $30,000. And I said, no problem. I knew we could do it. And we did it. But during that time, that was that amount of money. And eventually the salons were doing $1 million a year, which in my business was unheard of unless you were at Sassoon's level. So the other thing that was difficult was training hairdressers to cut hair and to be professional. And many times I had to send people home. People try to destroy the business because they didn't want to go along with the rules. They would break the rules. And then when they told me, do one in California, now I've got stylists I got to train out there and New York. And this was every other week I would fly from New York to California. In California, go straight to the salon. At the end of the week, I finish. Then I'm catching a flight back to New York. And I went to this acupuncturist, and I was getting tired from flying back and forth. And this was back in the day of People Airlines for $99 an hour. So he said, if you keep up this pace, you're going to be dead in 3 to 4 years. I said, okay, we're going to have to do something about this. So that's when I said, I need to train a manager, someone who can handle it. So my son wanted to live in L.A., and my daughter wanted to live in L.A. And so I trained them. And my daughter after she was dealing with the hairdressers, she said, these hairdressers are driving me crazy. But my son had the personality to deal with them. And thank God for him. I'm telling you, he he did it until eventually he wanted to go into his own thing. And I found a woman out there who, Francis, who started to manage. And then we had the computers come in so I could keep track of the money and the numbers. And that was something Vidal told me when I left him. He said, look, John, learn the numbers. And I didn't do it. And I suffered as a result. But eventually, you have to know the numbers. You won't be in business long. So anyway, so now I got managers. I don't have to fly out there as often as I can be in New York. But the biggest thing that happened to me during that time was building a relationship with my present wife, Sheila Frazier. And eventually, after 29 years, and she said yes. And it's been wonderful. It's been wonderful.
I remember walking down 161st Street because I was going to a meeting. And then I ran into you. And that's when Sheila said, oh.
Just come from the courthouse.
I want to tell you all that this has been a wonderful discussion. I want at some point to bring you all back because I know that there's a lots of stories. I know some of the stories that Chuck Carlton have and Joe has that they haven't even started on. So we're going to arrange to do that in the coming future. And I thank you all so much for being part of this broadcast. Y'all made it wonderful.
I'll say one thing before I go, because I'm active now. Anyone that would like to know what I'm doing, just Google Dr. Joseph Jackson Inventor. Okay. And then hit images. And then you're going to see all this stuff. Okay. Thank you very much.
I was going to ask you all, do you all have any way that you all want people to contact you if you're still doing business, especially money people, Carlton?
Yeah, what is my email address? Carlton@directinvestdevelopment.com.
Okay. I will put it up on the screen as we're closing. Thank you all so much for being on this broadcast. And thank you all for tuning in. It was a wonderful experience, and I look forward to having another show. The show next week is going to be with Audrey Edwards, who wrote a book entitled American Runaway. It's a show about getting away from America from Donald Trump. It's an interesting book, and it's going to be an interesting show. See you next week. Bye!
Thank you for tuning in this week. Hope you enjoyed this show about stuff. See you next time.
Visit the New Federal Theater's website at www.newfederaltheater.com to see upcoming performances and to donate today.